From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a hat, a coat, a gun, and our archives. We feature interviews from the hard-boiled section of our archives. We'll hear from Mickey Spillane, creator of Tough Guy Detective Mike Hammer, Lawrence Block, creator of the Matt Scudder series, Sue Grafton, who's making her way through the alphabet with titles like A is for Alibi down to J is for Judgment, and Walter Mosley, one of President Clinton's favorite detective writers. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Brian De Palma's new film Carlito's Way, starring Al Pacino as a former drug dealer trying to open a legit business. That's all coming up on our archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
President Clinton met today with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and promised financial aid to help meet the costs of implementing the Palestinian self-rule agreement. The president also promised to look into ways to help revive the peace negotiations between Israel and Syria, but he stopped short of committing himself publicly to help arrange secret talks. After a 90-minute meeting at the White House, the two leaders indicated that agreement was near on a $1.8 billion sale of American F-15 bombers. Such long-range aircraft would enable Israel to strike targets as far away as Iran and Iraq. Cancer death rates would have declined substantially since 1950 if Americans didn't smoke tobacco, according to a study published today. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Federal scientists say tobacco use is responsible for 20% of the deaths in this country, including one-third of all cancer deaths. The death rate for all cancers has been climbing since 1950, driven largely by a big increase in lung cancer. But a study in the federal government's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report says if you take away the effect of smoking, the death rate from all cancers would actually have declined by 14% since 1950. That's because there's been substantial improvement in treating many forms of cancer other than lung cancer. However, more people are being diagnosed with cancer now than they were 20 years ago, even when you set aside lung cancer. So, while smoking is the biggest problem, it can't explain all the bad news about cancer. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
H.R. Haldeman, who played a central role in the Watergate scandal, died this morning at his home in Santa Barbara, California. He was 67. Haldeman became a powerful figure in the White House 25 years ago when then-President Richard Nixon appointed him chief of staff. NPR's Renee Montaigne has more.
H.R. Haldeman, known as Bob, was the closest aide to Richard Nixon, the one with the distinctive crew cut who seemed always at Nixon's side, keeping others away. In a statement today, former President Nixon expressed sadness at the death of Bob Haldeman, characterizing his former chief of staff as playing, quote, an indispensable role in turbulent times. Haldeman was at the center of the greatest turbulence to hit the Nixon administration, a storm that finally brought down the president, the June 1972 break-in of Democratic headquarters located in a building called the Watergate. Haldeman maintained a large slush fund used to pay the Watergate burglars. As the scandal grew in the spring of 73, he resigned from the White House. Haldeman ultimately served a year and a half in prison for helping to cover up the break-in. H.R. Haldeman was suffering from abdominal cancer. He died in Santa Barbara in his sleep. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 22 points today. This is NPR. The Los Angeles coroner's office said today that actor River Phoenix died from a massive overdose of several drugs. The 23-year-old actor suffered convulsions and died outside a West Hollywood nightclub 2 weeks ago. Toxicological tests showed extremely high levels of heroin and cocaine in Phoenix's body. A coroner's spokesman said that the tests also found traces of marijuana, the prescription sedative Valium, and an over-the-counter cold medication. The coroner's office has ruled the death accidental. Searchers have found the last two bodies in the wreckage of yesterday's freight train collision in Washington State. That brings the total to 5 crew members killed. Guy Nelson of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
Federal investigators are looking through the twisted wreckage of the two freight trains to determine why they hit head-on yesterday morning near the city of Kelso. Preliminary indications are that a southbound Burlington Northern train missed a slowdown signal or the signal malfunctioned just before it collided with a northbound Union Pacific train on the same track. Another possibility is error by a dispatcher in Seattle, where the trains get their directions. The area is one of the busiest rail corridors in the country, serving up to 60 trains a day. Some of the black boxes from the five locomotives have been found and will be analyzed to determine the speed and control of the trains just before the accident. For National Public Radio, this is Guy Nelson in Seattle.
Roman Catholic Cardinal Joseph Bernardine denied today that he sexually abused a former seminary student who now has AIDS. Bernardine, the Archbishop of Chicago, was named along with another priest in a $10 million damage suit filed by Stephen Cook. The suit alleged that the abuse took place when Bernardine was Archbishop of Cincinnati. Bernardine said that he has never abused anyone that he cannot remember ever having met Cook. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is the hard-boiled edition of Fresh Air. Everyone on today's show has a detective alter ego, except me. It's the weekly archive edition of Fresh Air, and we go back to 1989 for our first interview with one of the best-known writers in the genre, Mickey Spillane, creator of tough guy detective Mike Hammer. Spillane wrote his first Mike Hammer novel in 1947. I, the Jury was followed by 11 other Hammer stories, including Vengeance is Mine, The Big Kill, and Kiss Me Deadly. Mike Hammer has also had a life in movies and on TV. In 1989, at the age of 71, Spillane revived Hammer in a novel called The Killing Man. Our interview starts with a reading from the first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury.
When I looked up, Pat was staring at me strangely. He shook his head. I knew what he was thinking. Mike, lay off. For God's sake, don't go half-cocked about this. I know you too well. You'll start shooting up anyone connected with this and getting a jam you'll never get out of. I'm over it now, Pat. Don't get excited. From now on, I'm after one thing, the killer. You're a cop, Pat. You're tied down by rules and regulations. There's someone over you. I'm alone. I can slap someone in the puss and they can't do a damn thing. No one can kick me out of my job. Maybe there's no way to put up a huge fuss if I get gunned down. But then I still have a private cop's license with the privilege of pack a rod and they're afraid of me. I hate hard, Pat. When I latch onto the one behind this, they're going to wish they hadn't started it. Someday, before long, I'm going to have my rod and my mitt and the killer in front of me. I'm going to watch the killer's face. I'm going to plunk one right in his gut when he's dying on the floor. I may kick his teeth out. You couldn't do that. You have to follow a book because you're a captain of homicide. Maybe the killer will wind up in a chair. You'd be satisfied, but I wouldn't. It's too easy. That killer is going down like Jack did.
Well, I think this sets up the character pretty well. And that whole sense of, and when he's dying on the floor, I may kick his teeth out.
Yeah. How about that?
So, I mean, what does that say about the character? I mean, what did you want to get in there?
Well, the character, something terrible has been done to Mike. His best friend has been shot. Not only shot, but has been shot in a horrible way because the killer wanted to see that guy hurt. Because shot him where it wasn't a death-dealing blow with that shot. He shot him in the gut. He's going to live a while. He's going to be in terrible pain. And that's the way that killer's going to die. So this is the premise of the whole story, that killer's going down just like Jack did, his friend did. And that's what happens.
And Mike Hammer says that in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through guys like me once in a while. You've made Hammer into the guy who's going to get justice outside of the law.
That's right. In this case, he's acting as a, you know, an arm of the law, but in a different way. He can do things that nobody else can do. He's got more reason for doing it. He's not hung up by rules and regulations the way the cop was. And it's a case of personal vendetta on his part. See, I never had Mike Hammer ever taking a case for money. Everything he ever got into was because of a personal motivation. Something happened to somebody he liked, somebody he loved, some situations were terrible, and he got into it. And with no money behind it, he was on his own all the way because this was a personal nature with him. And he needed all of his attention.
Hammer seems to take a lot of, almost pleasure in vengeance and in returning pain that's been received. Is it cathartic for you to write that way?
No, I never used that particular idea. When you're going into a tough situation, pain's going to be there. You don't want to dwell on these things. But there are certain episodes that require this type of thing. If you want to see pain, violence, sex, you read your newspapers. There's plenty of it there. We have to bring it in where it belongs in the book in order to make the book interesting. You just can't write all about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain rhythm. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really at your best when you're writing violent scenes. There's a certain rhythm that you get in those
scenes.
Yeah,
you can get mad when you write. I punch holes in my paper. The yo's make holes. The periods go right into the platinum of the machine. I break up typewriters so fast. That when I'm done with a story, that machine has to go in for repair. So you know what I'd do to if I ever worked with a word processor. I'd tear it apart.
At the end of Eye the Jury.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like perhaps your most famous scene?
Well, this is the one that's so well remembered. This is the one I told you about. They said it was a sensual scene. Now, see, Mike, he's got a premise in his life. He is going to kill the person who killed his friend in the same way by shooting him in the gut. Now, at the end of the story there, when he's faced down with this woman that he loves, Charlotte, she knows what he wants to do. She has to get him away from this attitude. She starts to unrobe. She takes her clothes off piece by piece. And the description is of her getting down to the point where she's nude. And then she leans over while she's about to kiss him. She's really reaching for a gun behind his head. Now, if he's true to his premise, he'll stay alive. If he's not true to it, she's going to kill him. And, of course, what he does, he stays true. He shoots her right in the gut. Now, she's a psychiatrist. She couldn't understand that. And she says, "How could you?" And he says, "It was easy." And that's the way he was. That was the end of the story.
And that's your most famous line, I think, that it was easy.
Oh, yeah, it was easy.
Was it considered very unusual to have the private eye kill a woman at the end of a book?
Well, they didn't used to do it in those days. Women were sort of held up on a pedestal. I knocked this one off. I've already killed, I think, two women. Made them villains in any of my stories, but they were effective.
Now, why is that something you wanted to topple in your story?
Women can be as deadly as men any time. Again, you know, just refer back to your newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun doing it to them. Of course, there are other times when women are treated with much more consideration than that.
Were there any limits, editorial limits, censorship limits to how much sex and violence you could use in the book and still be mass marketed? Were you always cognizant of what your limits were?
Well, the editors do funny things. When I wrote One Lonely Night, Mike Hammer killed off 200 people with a machine gun, kept reloading and shooting. He was in a commie nest, a real deadly area, and he shot 200 people. And the editor says, "Oh, that's much too much blood." So they knocked it down to 100 people.
That was supposed to be a big change.
That's your editorial concept.
In your novels, women lick their luscious lips seductively a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm a woman and not a man, but I've really never seen a woman lick her lips.
Well, you never were watching.
Perhaps.
That's a little game they play. You know.
Have you seen that a lot? Because I remember.
Sure, I've seen it many times. The French said they make a moo, M-O-U-E. You know,
Mickey Spillane is my guest, and he's written his first Mike Hammer novel in 19 years. I read that you were actually with the police on the bust of a narcotics ring.
Oh, I was on several of those big ones. Yeah.
But that you took two bullets on one of them.
Well, I got one. Uh-huh. That was enough. Well, it was one shot, but it was a buckshot in the darn thing. Whenever you go out playing around, you're going to get hurt. So the best thing to do, don't go where trouble happens. Otherwise, you're going to be part of it, and then you can get clobbered. I'm not about looking for any of these things anymore. I'll use everything that's in my mind. I will use my imagination. I'll get into fiction and keep it that way. I don't want any more realism. That gets to be rough.
Well, this is a kind of weird question, but when you actually were shot... I don't know if this is too weird or not, but how did it compare with how you imagined it was when you had characters being shot in your books?
Well, it was a little bit screwy because I was standing behind a whole bunch of tomato paste. There was a slogan for this tomato paste. Who put those six big tomatoes in the itty-bitty cans? And the bullet went through the cans, got everybody splashed with tomato paste, and everybody thought they had all been shot as well.
Oh, gee.
So the shot just sprayed around, and it was...
How bizarre. Since you had tomato sauce all over, were you able to figure out right away where the actual wound was?
Yeah, you'll know right where that is. Right, but okay. You're not considering that right away. All you know is everybody got clobbered, and that was, you know, there you. It was kind of hard to get the tomato sauce off, though. It wasn't deadly, I'll tell you that.
So is the sensation something that you've recalled for writing?
No. You're better off if you use your imagination. You know, writing is something completely different. When you're writing fiction, it's easy. You can do things with fiction that nobody ever believed in. Words are great. They're expressive. You can say things that you'd never experience and make them sound real. Hey, that's what being a writer is all about. I have as much fun writing as I do have reading.
You've said that the first part of a story that comes to you is the ending, because that's where you have
sure.
to get to, and that's in your novels the most, the kind of, you know, the dramatic climax. Seems to me your titles come from the last page, too.
Not always. No. When you're writing, see, it's like a joke. The only part of a joke you listen to is that punchline. So when you develop a story, that's your important part, is the big ending on there. Now, O. Henry did this in all of his stuff, and he was an old-time writer. I've just gone ahead and elaborated on his style a little bit in the structure of a story. Titles come out of the air. I don't know where they come from, but when I was doing The Killing Man, we couldn't get a title for that. And we were writing down all sorts of titles. We put them on the computers looking for any duplications and whatnot. And I was sitting there, all of a sudden I looked at it, I said, The Killing Man, that's it. And it just popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't try for a title until after the book is finished.
Something I recently learned about you is that you are, or were, I'm not sure which, a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I've been a Jehovah's Witness since 1951.
You know, what surprised me about that was that I know you're not your character, but, I mean, Hammer is such the man alone that it seemed, like, hard for me to fathom that you were, you know, part of an organized religion.
Well, I'm not going to discuss it with you now, but next time one of Jehovah's Witnesses knocks on the door, call them in. They'll tell you all about it. But religion's a strange thing, you know. It's something you have personally in your lives, and you got to believe in it, and I believe in what I believe in.
Can I ask if the witnesses have ever objected to your books?
No. I don't think they read them, and I don't blame them. But... No, what you're writing is just this is a job with me. I don't write for any express purpose like passing messages around. It's strictly a job. I try to keep them fairly contemporary and fairly clean. The first time I used a four-letter word in a book, I thought the publishers were going to go out of their minds, and this was a long time after it was coming out in other books. I don't try to use bad language, mainly because these are, again, our exclamation points within the story. And I try to keep things as... normal as possible. Anybody wants to read violence and sex, go to the newspaper. There's plenty of it there.
Something else I recently learned about you is that you collect blue willow pottery.
Yeah.
Which is a surprising hobby for a hard-boiled guy.
Well, it's not a one-time blue willow was just cheap kitchenware for all the farm ladies all over the country. It was made by different companies, but there was a classic thing about it. It was all excellently made. It was great chinaware, cheap, very cheap. But now it's up on the stage where, you know, it becomes antique and looks nice. And I lost a whole mess of it down in the hurricane.
Yeah.
And my wife collects pewterware, and she lost her pewterware. But we'll get it back. There's a lot of it out there, and the fun is going out collecting these things and doing it again. And I like it. It's useful. It's pretty looking. And it reminds me of my childhood, because we had it at home.
Well, speaking of your childhood... Your father was a bartender?
Yeah, he was a good Irish bartender in Brooklyn.
So, did you hang out at that bar?
No, I would never hang out at a bar because I don't like the atmosphere of a bar. It's nobody goes into a bar to get sober, and again, it's a trouble spot. Bar scenes where you have restaurants. Well, this is a different situation. But when you speak of a bar, you know what you're speaking of is like a neighborhood pub type of bar where everybody's in there and they finally it's a place where they go and they don't want to go home. But I don't hang around in those places. Mm-hmm. I never did.
Mickey Spillane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mickey Spillane recorded in 1989. We'll be right back with detective writer Lawrence Block after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Lawrence Block has a new novel featuring his private eye, Matt Scudder. Block has written over 10 Scudder novels. Scudder's turf is Manhattan. Scudder is a former cop who quit the force after he accidentally shot and killed a teenager. He left his wife, two kids, and home in the suburbs, and now lives alone in a small, dingy hotel room. Of the Lawrence Block novels I've read, my favorite is 8 Million Ways to Die, which was published in 1982. This moody novel was a turning point for Detective Scudder. After years of hard drinking, he tried staying sober and joined AA. It wasn't easy for this cynical loner to feel at home in a support group. In 1992, we asked Lawrence Block to read an excerpt.
I got to the meeting a couple of minutes early. Half a dozen people said hello to me by name. I got some coffee and sat down. The speaker told an abbreviated drinking story and spent most of the time telling of all the things that had happened to him since he got sober 4 years ago. His marriage had broken up, his youngest son had been killed by a hit-and-run driver, he'd gone through a period of extended unemployment and several bad bouts of clinical depression. I wanted to leave at the break. Instead, I got a cup of coffee and took a couple of Fig Newtons. I ate the cookies. It was like chewing straw, but I chewed them and washed them down. During the discussion, one woman got into a long riff about her relationship. She was a pain in the ass. She said the same thing every night. I tuned out. I thought, my name is Matt and I'm an alcoholic. A woman I know got killed last night. She hired me to keep her from getting killed, and I wound up assuring her that she was safe and she believed me. And her killer conned me and I believed him, and she's dead now and there's nothing I can do about it. And it eats at me, and I don't know what to do about that. And there's a bar on every corner and a liquor store on every block. And drinking won't bring her back to life, but neither will staying sober. And why the hell do I have to go through this? Why? I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and we sit around in these goddamned rooms and say the same damn things all the time. And meanwhile, out there, all the animals are killing each other. We say, don't drink and go to meetings, and we say, the important thing is you're sober, and we say, easy does it, and we say, one day at a time, and while we natter on like brainwashed zombies, the world is coming to an end. I thought, my name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic, and I need help. When they got to me, I said, my name is Matt. Thanks for your qualification. I enjoyed it. I think I'll just listen tonight.
Lawrence Block, thanks for reading that passage from 8 Million Ways to Die. You know, having your main character, Matthew Scudder, having given up alcohol creates this intense mood of constant craving for what he can't have. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, life is kind of drained of color and meaning during these periods when he's really craving alcohol. I guess what got you thinking about how you could use that in the novel?
Well, the Matthew Scudder series of books evolved gradually. 8 Million Ways to Die was the fifth book in the series. And in the first three books, he's a hard drinker who doesn't really pay much mind to the effects or implications of his drinking. And when I started writing the books, I fully intended that he would stay like that forever. Most series detectives certainly are static characters. They don't change much. That's always been the case. And I found as the series progressed, the fourth book was called A Stab in the Dark, and in that one he's beginning to see that there's something pathological about his drinking but doesn't really want to look at it. And in 8 Million Ways to Die, that was a pivotal book in which his struggles with his alcoholism and his being forced to come to terms with that are really as much a part of the book as is the solution of a crime.
I find it interesting, you know, that you've taken this character who loves hanging out at bars, and a lot of his sources are at bars, and he even goes to bars after joining AA because that's kind of where he lives. I wonder, well, I should ask you first if you had a problem with alcohol and if you had to give it up and if you're writing out of a first-person knowledge about some of these things.
Well, I don't like to talk about that too much, but I will say that I used to drink rather the way Scudder did, and I don't drink anymore.
Do you still hang out in bars? I mean, is there something about bars that you like very much, in spite of the fact that you can partake of the alcohol?
No, not particularly. My own experience is that bar conversation that may have seemed fascinating and stimulating years ago seemed to require a fairly high blood level of alcohol in order to be all that absorbing.
So why does your character keep going back?
Well, there's only really one bar that he hangs out at a lot, and that's because of a particular relationship he has with a fellow he met. Yeah, I should probably say that I thought the books were going to end with 8 Million Ways to Die. That seemed to be a catharsis in the character's life, and I thought, gee, there's no place to go after this. His detra has lost its raison. You know, he's still a detective, but you know, let him go get a life on his own time. But it turned out that I liked the character a lot. I liked seeing the world through those particular eyes and all. And I did write further books about it. The 10th is called A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Writer Lawrence Block is my guest. Let me get back to 8 Million Ways to Die again for a second. You know, the main character keeps reading the New York Daily News, and every day there's another really gruesome murder that's taken place that's in the headlines. And that's where the title 8 Million Ways to Die comes
from. Right.
Because for each person in New York, there's another way of possibly being murdered or killed. What's your reaction when you read that stuff in the paper?
Well, it was interesting, and that particular book, when I was writing that, I was living up in Washington Heights at that particular time, and I would do my day's work, and then I would leave the house generally late afternoon, pick up a copy of the news, and get on the subway and ride downtown. And the horrible stories that Scudder dutifully reports each time were the ones that I'd read the night before and that I then would write about. You know, the city never failed to provide heinous atrocities for me to report in the next day's writing. It was quite bizarre.
A lot of despair in a lot of crime fiction, in part because the detective is often lonely and is exposed to the most brutal aspects of society. And I'd say probably not so much in the more recent stuff, but, you know, Scudder has dealt with his share of despair. There must be something about that kind of mood that you personally respond to.
Oh, sure. I don't always walk along humming, you know, but I think this is a hard world, and most people have a great deal of grief in their lives, you know, and I don't feel it's my mission solely to reflect that in my work, and a lot of my work is quite lighthearted. Certainly there's a series of books I did about a burglar named Bernie Rodenbar, which they're also set in New York, and it's a different New York from the one that Scudder lives in. The streets are the same, but the feel is different.
Does it ever feel odd to you that the character you've created is always having these life-endangering adventures while you're almost always sitting home and typing?
Well, no, I haven't thought about that much. I suppose in certain respects, Scudder's life is more interesting and dramatic than mine, but otherwise he'd be sitting around writing about me.
Lawrence Block recorded last year. Lawrence Block's new Matt Scudder novel is called The Devil Knows You're Dead. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More detective writers on the second half of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Most private eyes are white guys. Coming up, we'll hear about two private eyes who aren't. We'll hear from Sue Grafton, creator of A Smart and Tough Woman Private Eye. Her books are bestsellers. And we'll hear from Walter Mosley, whose detective, like Mosley, is African-American. Mosley is one of Bill Clinton's favorite writers. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Carlito's Way, starring Al Pacino and Sean Penn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton tried today to bolster Israeli Prime Minister Rabin and at the same time send a signal of reassurance to Israel. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
After meetings with Rabin at the White House, President Clinton reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to supporting Israel financially and militarily so that Israel maintains its superiority over its Arab neighbors. President Clinton pledged to keep U.S. aid to Israel at current levels, and he said he would ask Congress to allow Israel to use American loan guarantees to pay for projects in the West Bank and Gaza related to the peace process. And the two countries are also discussing ways the U.S. can help Israel maintain its military superiority. Israel wants to buy F-15E fighter planes, highly sophisticated warplanes which no other country has been allowed to purchase. Rabin will meet with Secretary of Defense Les Aspin on Monday to discuss the jet sale. The White House hopes that all the assistance discussed serves as a confidence-building measure, boosting political support in Israel for Rabin himself and for the peace process. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
37 nations, including the U.S., have voted to ban the dumping of nuclear waste at sea. This ban takes the place of a voluntary embargo on the dumping of low-level nuclear waste that has been in place for 10 years. While there were no votes against the new agreement, five nations abstained, including four nuclear powers: Britain, France, Russia, and China. Last month, Russia was found to be sending 237,000 gallons of low-level nuclear waste into the Sea of Japan. In New York City, the UN said today that it plans to send 13 relief officials to Haiti this weekend to help aid efforts on the island. The move comes after a Harvard University study charged that up to 1,000 children a month are dying as a result of the UN embargo. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Dispatch of additional humanitarian relief representatives comes as both U.S. and UN officials criticized the Harvard University study. A U.S. diplomat said the research was based on only one of hundreds of Haitian feeding stations and that extrapolating conclusions from this was erroneous. U.N. Special Envoy Dante Caputo also criticized the report, saying the Harvard team did not spend sufficient time in Haiti to get an accurate view of the situation. Caputo made his remarks after briefing members of the Security Council. Diplomats said afterwards that Caputo urged council members to maintain pressure on Haiti's military. He also criticized the United States for withdrawing its military observers from the island. He said the move had encouraged Haiti's military to be intransigent. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 22 points to close at 3,684.51 on volume of more than 322 million shares. This is NPR News. Federal officials have announced that there will be an investigation of possible violations in last week's governor's race in New Jersey. The probe is tied to charges that the campaign of Governor-elect Christy Whitman suppressed black voting in the election. Earlier this week, Ed Rollins, top aide in the campaign, said that some $500,000 was paid in the form of contributions to black ministers and Democratic workers to discourage them from rallying voters. Whitman has denied the charge. A rainstorm in Southern California yesterday caused mudslides in some of the areas recently hit by wildfires. And with another storm predicted to begin sometime soon, residents are working to protect their homes. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Residents of the coastal communities of Malibu and Laguna Beach are putting sandbags on their streets and around their homes, trying to prevent what happened to some of their neighbors yesterday. About 24 homes were damaged in Laguna Beach. The rain there sent mud cascading down the streets and through the doors of a handful of houses, leaving behind muck several feet deep. The narrow canyon road that leads into the town was partially closed for a while, as was all but one lane of the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu. Mudslides became a grave concern here after wildfires scorched 200,000 acres from Ventura to the Mexico border. Since the hills have been stripped of vegetation, there are no roots to hold the soil in place. Also, drainage pipes and catch basins that channel water from the hillsides were damaged in the fires. Yesterday's mudslides were caused by relatively little rain, less than half an inch in most places, and California's rainy season is just beginning. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Medical officials in Los Angeles say that actor River Phoenix died of a drug overdose. Officials say an autopsy indicated extremely high levels of heroin and morphine. There were also traces of marijuana, Valium, and an over-the-counter co-medication. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Crime novels have been dominated by white detectives. Walter Mosley is the creator of today's most popular African-American detective, E.Z. Rollins. I spoke with Mosley in 1990, after the publication of his first E.Z. Rollins novel, Devil in a Blue Dress. The story is set in Los Angeles in 1948. E.Z. Rollins, a World War II veteran, just got laid off from his job at a defense plant for standing up to his boss. E.Z. is broke, so he accepts an offer from a white gangster to track down a white woman who has a predilection for black men. The search takes E.Z. into all the black bars he knows, but it also leads him into parts of the white world he is unfamiliar with, people and places that are very threatening. This is the opening of Devil in a Blue Dress.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame, and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948. I had spent 5 years with white men and women from Africa to Italy, through Paris and into the fatherland itself. I ate with them and slept with them, and I killed enough blue-eyed young men to know that they were just as afraid to die as I was.
Now, your novel set in 1948, which is around 4 years before you were born.
Yeah.
This is based on stories your father told you? I don't mean the story of the novel, but the setting, the period.
Yeah, the idea is when I was a little kid, maybe 5, 6, 7, I would be with my father and his friends, and they would tell stories which really kind of came into my heart. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid and you listen to these wild stories that people are telling, they become part of you. So it's like I was alive then, in a way.
What were most of the stories about?
Most of the stories are about survival and having a good time. I think most of the stories are about how hard life was and how enjoyable life was. You know, a story once my father told me he was in a bar with his wife and his cousin. And some guy was bothering his wife. And my father, as a young man, pulls a knife on this guy. And my cousin grabbed the knife out of his hand because she said that if she killed the guy, she could get out of trouble by morning. And she tried to stab the guy, and she stabbed my father instead in the leg.
Jeez.
That was funny. But, like, she was there, my father was there, and they were all laughing about it, and it was, like, a great time. So I thought it was wonderful.
How did she plan, by the way, to get out of trouble if she killed the guy?
There was an idea, at least, that she had that if a man attacked a black woman or had a fight with a black woman, a black man, that the judge wouldn't worry about it, just let him go. In Houston. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what they thought.
Now, your character of E.Z. Rollins fought in World War II, and that's where he was first really around a lot of other white men. Was there an equivalent of the war in terms of an experience or something that exposed you to the white world, or did you just grow up in a racially mixed world, unlike your father?
Yeah, my mother's white, and so... Yeah, I've always been in a racially mixed world. But a lot of the people that I was with it was new to them, or always new to them, like white people who had only been around white people most of their lives and most of their important experiences, so had trouble with black people, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Although your mother was white and your father was black, when you were outside of the family, did people just see you as black as opposed to, you know, being of a mixed background?
Well, yeah. I mean, in America, you're black if you're at all black, right? I mean, there's not really too much difference between being half black or a quarter black and all black. I mean, you are if you are.
There's a scene where Easy gets arrested by cops, and he says, well, he's played the game of cops and nigger before. What's the game?
Well, the game is not giving up information, basically. That they're going to have an attitude that you did something wrong. And that's not going to change. And so you're going to have to continually say, I didn't do it. I'm not wrong. And they're going to continually say that you are, and you just have to weather that. I've experienced that. I got stopped by a policeman in Los Angeles, in the hills, and the guy actually pulled a gun on me and asked me, did I break into this building that was standing there? And I had to keep saying no, and he kept holding his gun on me, saying, I know you did it. Now all you have to do is tell me. And I was so nervous, but it finally just kind of went away after a while.
It's hard to convince someone that you're innocent when they're certain that you're guilty.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's kind of hard to convince yourself, actually. You know, when there's enough pressure to say you're guilty, you feel, well, I'll be safe if I say I'm guilty. He won't shoot me if I do that, or he won't hit me, or he won't put me in jail. Then maybe I'll just say that. But, of course, that doesn't work either.
You know, without giving away too much about your novel, I will say that one character in it is of mixed background,
mm-hmm.
Like you are, but they are really screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, they cannot handle being part white and part black.
Yeah.
Did you have friends like that who really couldn't handle it?
Well, it's an interesting thing when the idea of being a mulatto in America, because what I said before, externally people see you as being black, but internally, of course, you identify with people who you're close to and you loved. I've been very close to my mother's side of the family as well as my father's. So there's a kind of an alienation you feel from almost everyone, because you'll find, or at least I found when I was growing up, that a lot of black people felt that white people were different, not the same. And that's not something I ever felt. I said, well, you know, white people are like me, because these are people I've known my whole life. So, and as far as that's concerned, yes, I identify with the character that you're talking about in the book.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah. My parents are both alive.
I wonder, since the book seems in a way like, well, an almost homage to your father, I mean, because there seems to be a lot of the stories he told in there. What he thinks of the book?
Well, he likes the book, actually. Though it's very funny. I was talking to him a few months ago when he first read it, and he asked me, seriously, I think, he says, well, Walter, where am I in this book? And I thought it was so funny, because I told him, I said, well, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, your history, your background and stuff. And but he couldn't notice it, and I thought that was very funny.
Well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Thank you, too.
Walter Mosley recorded in 1990. His latest novel is White Butterfly. Back with Sue Grafton after this break. This is Fresh Air. Women have recently made a lot of inroads into the detective genre. One of the most successful writers is Sue Grafton, creator of Private Eye Kinsey Milhone. Milhone is in her 30s and, quote, twice married, no kids, and currently unattached and likely to remain so given my disposition, which is cautious at best. Grafton's first Milhone novel, A is for Alibi, was published in 1982. She's worked her way up through the alphabet to J, which is J is for Judgment.
I spoke with Sue Grafton in 1989 and asked her about the first Kinsey Millhone novel, which ended with Millhone facing a moral crisis. She killed someone in self-defense. She says, quote, "The shooting disturbs me still. It has moved me into the same camp with soldiers and maniacs. I never set out to kill anyone. I'll recover, of course. I'll be ready for business again in a week or two, but I'll never be the same."
What I am interested in doing, aside from the fact of the mystery itself, is talking about its effect on Kinsey Millhone. One of the things that always seemed true of me of mysteries in general is the prime character, the protagonist, seems not to be affected by the murder and mayhem. And I wanted to use Kinsey Millhone not only as a way of observing society, but showing her reaction and the changes it brings about in her own personality. So I think you'll see her grow and change because of the violence.
When you started writing detective fiction, were you self-conscious about being a woman and self-conscious about figuring out how to make this a more feminist crime series than a macho one?
No, I was self-conscious, but primarily because I was ill at ease with some of the technicalities of writing detective fiction. When I started AS for Alibi, I didn't even know what a private investigator did. So in the course of writing that book, I did a lot of reading on forensics and California criminal law, ballistics, auto and theft and burglary and that sort of thing. And I think my self-consciousness was the sense of not being qualified to do the writing. And one of the reasons I made Kinsey Millhone female is because I felt like that was an area in which I had a little expertise.
What other kinds of research did you have to do before you felt confident in writing a convincing crime story?
I learned to shoot a handgun. I took women's self-defense. All of the books take me down dark alleys. For instance, when I did See Us for Corpse, I went to visit two morgues so that I would know what that looked like. I did a ride-along with the police in Santa Barbara one night, and that was a bit of an eye-opener because I tend to go to bed very early, and to see what goes on in that town after 10 o'clock was sort of astonishing.
Now, it's interesting. Your detective, Kinsey Millhone, has no family. Her parents were killed in a car accident when she was 5 years old. And I'd like to read something that she says in F is for Fugitive, your new book.
All right.
Now, in this scene, she's having dinner with a family. They're all pretty crazy in this family. And she says, "As a child, I didn't experience much in the way of family, and I usually find myself somewhat taken aback to see one at close range. The Donna Reed Show, this was not. People talk about dysfunctional families. I've never seen any other kind." You know, one of the things I always find interesting in most detective novels is that the character has kind of given up on the idea of family.
Mm.
They don't have any expectations for it.
All right. Well, I know Kinsey will never marry again. She will never have children. But part of that is because I think the tradition of the hard-boiled private eye is that of a loner, the sort of knight-errant. And in part, I made those choices because in the writing of detective fiction, I didn't want to stop and deal with Aunt Maudie and Uncle Herman and everybody gathered around. So she has a sort of surrogate family in Henry Pitts and Rosie, the woman who owns the tavern in her neighborhood. But I didn't want to deal with family gatherings at Christmas time and that sort of thing. So it is a choice I made, and I feel it's the correct one in terms of the kind of book I'm writing.
When you started this series, how did you come up with the A is for Alibi? And did you think at the time that you would be committing yourself to a B, C, D, E, F, and so on?
It had been in the back of my mind to try a series based on something. So A is for Alibi came out of a personal situation of my own in which I was going through a very bitter divorce. And at the time, I was not very effectual as a fighter. I have since learned quite a lot about how to fight legal battles, but I used to lie awake at night and think of ways to kill the man. However, because I am such a law-abiding little bun, I knew I'd get caught at it. For one thing, I think the cops are very smart. I think people are foolish who imagine they can outwit the police. And I am the sort of person who does not even turn a library book in late. Also, if I get a parking ticket, I know they're discussing me down at the police station. And I don't, that makes me uncomfortable. So I decided that the next best thing would be to take the murder, put it in a book, and get paid for it. And in essence, I have launched an entire new career for myself out of mere homicidal rage.
You know, we were talking earlier about being a woman writing crime fiction in which there's a woman detective. There's a group called Sisters in Crime, which is an organization of women who write crime novels. And from what I understand, you've decided not to join.
That's right. And I'll tell you some of my reasons. I'm so happy you asked me that. For starters, I don't think writing is gender related. And I prefer to keep the politics out of writing. I see us as one group. I see our problems as applying to all of us, whether we're male or female. I also don't think I need to join a group to show that I am pro-women. And I am, I suspect, too much of a rebel, and Kinsey is too much of a renegade to connect myself to any group. I'm tired of getting people's newsletters. You know, every time you join a group, they send you this crappy newsletter, and I just don't want to do that anymore. I want to keep the writing pure for that, you know?
Well, it's funny you should say that. A friend of mine who reads a lot of crime fiction always thinks it's very funny that any detective writer who spends their days and nights writing about loners would care to join an organization.
That's right. That's right.
But do you find, though, that your concerns as a woman writer are ever at odds with some of the men in the crime writing profession?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I have found the men in Mystery Writers of America some of the warmest, most supportive people. I don't like to get into the us against them mentality, and I don't, in truth, think that's what Sisters in Crime is saying. I don't think they're maintaining that it is the men in MWA who are the enemy. I think their concerns are related to reviewers and critics and publishers and that sort of thing, but to my way of thinking, the book business is about selling books, and it seems to me if you are a writer who earns money for a publisher, you will be treated well.
Was there a time when you would have joined Sisters in Crime if for no other reason than to not alienate other women in it?
Yeah, see, but that did go through my mind, too, because when I first understood I wasn't going to do it, it scared me silly. But I thought, wait a minute, these people don't have any power over me, and I'm not going to do things in my life anymore just because of the way it looks. If I don't believe it, I'm not going to do it. But I am not the only one, you know. I am not the Lone Ranger out there. There are many other women who were feeling pressured by the organization and who determined that they also did not want to join. We just haven't formed a group because we don't like groups.
Have you found that Kinsey Millhone's courage is contagious?
Yes. Often I find that I look at the world through her eyes, and I think to myself, Kinsey Millhone would not be intimidated, and therefore, whether it scares me or not, I had better straighten up my act.
Sue Grafton, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sue Grafton recorded in 1989. Her latest novel is J is for Judgment. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin held a joint press conference today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report from Mar Eliason about Prime Minister Rabin's visit to Washington and also about his call, endorsed by President Clinton, that Chairman Arafat of the PLO should urge an end to all violence that's required by the PLO-Israeli agreement. Also, we'll be hearing about Joseph Cardinal Bernardin of Chicago, saying he is completely innocent of charges that he sexually abused a young man many years ago. The man brought suit today in Cincinnati. And story of a murder case in which some say a witness who has told the story of the murder is an African gray parrot.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Brian De Palma has had a bumpy career. Up with Carrie, Dressed to Kill and Scarface, down with Body Double and Wise Guys, back up again with The Untouchables, and then down to rock bottom with The Bonfire of the Vanities in 1990. Now after last year's Raising Cain, which sank quietly at the box office, De Palma has turned back to the gangster genre. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see Carlito's Way.
I don't think there's anyone alive who can film an action scene more voluptuously than Brian De Palma. He turns chases and shootouts into gorgeous dancing geometries without ever letting up on the white-knuckle stuff. And he can create more dread with a slow tracking shot than you ever thought possible. In Carlito's Way, he delivers two breathtaking action sequences, one at the beginning of the movie and one at the end. The problem is what happens in between. Al Pacino plays Charlie, known as Carlito, a Puerto Rican drug dealer who's gotten out of a 30-year prison sentence 25 years early, thanks to the machinations of his buddy and lawyer, Dave, played by Sean Penn, doing a wicked Alan Dershowitz imitation. The strange thing about Carlito is that when he says he now wants to go straight, he means it. Dave helps him get set up running an impossibly glitzy East Harlem disco, and pretty soon Carlito is stashing away enough money to realize his dream of leaving the country for Paradise Island, where he wants to, believe it or not, go into the car rental business. Meanwhile, he's gotten back together with his old girlfriend, Gail, played by Penelope Ann Miller. She's a dancer who's getting by these days as a stripper. The trouble is, the movie's taking place in the 70s. Everything is disco and cocaine, and Carlito's pal Dave is right in the thick of it. Not only is he snorting coke until his eyes jiggle, he's run afoul of the mob, and now he prevails on Carlito to help him out just this once, none of which is easy for poor Carlito to explain to Gail.
I gotta do this, just this one thing, and then I'm out. I owe Dave...
You
I gotta...
don't know him! You think you do, Charlie? That's the problem with you. That's why nobody like you gets out, no matter what they say.
You're not listening to me, girl.
Because everything you learned in the neighborhood, every instinct you've got, won't do anything but get you killed.
What are you talking about? How do you know what I learned in my neighborhood? You're just stupid, what you say.
I know how this dream ends, Charlie. It isn't in paradise. It ends with me carrying you into Sutton emergency room at 3 o'clock in the morning and standing there crying like an idiot while your shirt smells with blood and you die.
You're not listening to me!
For all his pyrotechnical skill, De Palma has never been very good at the tamer business of creating a convincing romantic relationship. And the one in Carlito's Way is pretty deadly. When Penelope Ann Miller tries to convince us of how heartbreaking it's been for her to watch her showbiz dreams corrode, you may think the film is poking fun at all those gangsters' malls in movies of the 30s who said the same thing. Except De Palma seems to be taking her seriously, which I'm afraid is more than the audience can manage. Meanwhile, the movie's central moral dilemma is about whether Carlito should help his friend Dave, even if it means turning back to crime. But that's thrown off kilter by Sean Penn's amazing performance. Penn makes Dave so coke-addled and loathsome that Carlito's loyalty to him seems less noble than moronic. Pacino is, as always, magnetic on the screen. But for long stretches, Carlito's Way is strangely flat. It's as if De Palma were simply going through the motions, forcing himself to slog through plot and character development and romance just so he could get to those killer action scenes that really do knock you off your feet.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Abby Fanta and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Forward into the Past. The comedy group Firesign Theater has reunited. They'll tell us the true stories of Nick Danger, Third Eye, and George L. Tirebiter. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll beat the Reaper and join us for the next Fresh Air.